everyone, and welcome to the Security Magazine video podcast. I'm your host, Ian Thornton Trump, and I'm joined by Comrade Lisa Forte and Comrade Philip Ingram. We're going to talk about Iran.
I think so. We're sponsored by Cyjax, and we're doing it for Security Magazine. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah. I left that part out, but that's okay. So now that we have our topic of conversation, this is really timely because Cyjax has put out a wonderful piece of content on China, and we have had Comrade Lisa has just returned from China, and we're really delighted to and excited to talk about those issues. So broadly speaking, Lisa, any major revelations that you want to drop at the beginning of this podcast?
I think for me, I went to China with a lot of preconceived ideas of what China was going to be and what the issues were going to be. And I was completely wrong on a large quantity of them. Now, that's not to say that there aren't really serious issues and we will address some of those, but I was totally off the mark on where I thought they would be. So I think it was really eye-opening to me. And it wasn't like I just went to Beijing. I went to literally middle of nowhere China, to the point where this place where I was, Westerners have never been. Like, people haven't seen white people. So people literally followed me around with cameras taking photos of me and were completely enamored with the fact that there was this blonde woman.
Yeah, but that's your pop star status anyway. That happens even in London.
For different reasons.
I think that's a great place to start. And this is, I think, really informed by the news that we get about China is coming from Western think tanks, Western media. Phil, I mean, you've been you've seen both sides of these types of sort of geopolitical conflicts. To kick us off, what is your view on where China sees itself in the world right now?
China sees itself as an aspiring world leader. Regional, first of all, global second, from a political perspective. It has ambitions to equal the United States, if not better the United States, but it's got a completely different approach to the way it's doing things. It believes the world doesn't get China properly. I think politically they think that China isn't a threat to anyone, but China does actually want to control business and, where possible, politics across large portions of the globe, and have got plans to do that and are implementing them. China thinks very slowly when it comes to political and the way it's doing things, but it thinks very far out. So it's looking 25 years plus ahead. And its slow movement is taking slow nibbles and slow bites as it's dealing with things. I think in China itself there are different layers. What we see from an international perspective, a political perspective, that is interacting with the West is completely different to those that are in positions of influence within the cities in China, which is completely different to those sorts of people that you'll have seen out in the middle of the Ulu that's in there. And to try and lump it all, it's huge in so many different ways. To try and lump it all into one little label, which we call China, and therefore we're interacting with it, is us oversimplifying to a degree that means that our general analysis is not good. But they have global ambitions economically. They have global ambitions politically, and they've got plans in place to achieve them.
So Lisa, I mean, obviously you're kind of in the middle of it. You were in some of the cities. You were also out in the country. What is top of mind from the Chinese perspective right now? How do they see themselves as, you know, outward looking?
I think just to start, you know, Phil touched upon how they're sort of seeing themselves as overtaking the US. Well, actually, the IMF and the World Economic League have said that will happen in 2030. If nothing, you know, changes, everyone's sort of saying that China's growth has sort of stumbled, and that's true. But they've seen absolutely unprecedented growth since 1990. It's been absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, the rapid industrial...
Correct.
And this was the thing that struck me after reading an economist and Forbes basically saying, well, China's gross domestic product is decreasing. it's still at 4.5%.
Yeah.
Better than Europe.
Yeah.
Arguably better than the United States currently, although Bidenomics has seemed to kind of hit the accelerator on the American economy. But the love-hate relationship between the United States right now, painting China as an aggressive, as a nation that steals intellectual property, you know, do the Chinese see that as sort of a more of a birthright, or how do they view it?
So I would say that obviously I'm only talking about China from the perspective of someone who visited China. I'm not living in China, I'm not Chinese, so I can't talk to their perspective from that.
Well, what they've shared with you.
But from sitting down with a load of them, there were a couple of things that I thought were really interesting from buying, and I guess this comes back to the point that the three of us have talked about a lot, which is that actually, are you buying into your own propaganda from your own state? And I went there and I realized, and I always sort of prided myself on thinking that I was relatively impartial and I was seeking out different news sources. And when I got there, I was like, oh, you're not. You have bought into all of that propaganda, which just isn't true. For example, they watch BBC News. There's no censorship from the perspective that they don't have access to Western news. They're watching Western news. They're speaking English. You know, it's not that kind of cut-off society that we like to think it is, or that we like to sort of talk about.
Well, they're doing that out in the middle of the countryside as well as in the cities.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
There's access to all of that sort of stuff. It's really not cut off, which is one thing I massively misunderstood, along with the sort of censorship side of things. And I've given this quite a lot of thought, actually, and I think what happens, so China does have censorship. It seems to me that the only real rule is that you cannot overtly criticize Xi Jinping or the CCP online. Offline, different story. People are talking pretty openly about criticisms of, and you know, pros and cons of the government and things like that, as you would find here, which surprised me. But online, what tends to happen, and I know this because one of the gentlemen that I was climbing with, He'd actually had this happen. He posted something online that was very critical of Xi, and this process kind of went through. So the first sort of time you do it, they just take it down. That's it. You don't hear anything else. It just disappears from whatever platform you've used. The second time you do it, there's a phrase in Chinese where they say, "Would you like to go for tea?" which indicates that you want to go for a little chat. And somebody from the police will basically sit down and talk to you and ask you why you did it and what your motivations are and so on and so forth, explain why it's not appropriate. If you then obviously continue down a path of doing it, you're going to start getting more and more negative attention and eventually arrest. But it's not the situation that they come around to your house, drag you out in the middle of the night with your family. And I was giving this some thought, and I think the problem we have is that we in the West understand sort of authoritarianism and this kind of censorship. And we look at the models we've previously looked at, so like the NKVD and the Savak in Iran. And we've gone, this is what they do. This is what censorship looks like. So therefore it looks like that in every country.
Yeah, we're only seeing it through the lens of authoritarian regime.
But I think there might be another explanation for it, because we would not know about the first posting and it just been taken down, the second posting, the little informal chat and all the rest of it. The first time it would actually come to the attention of anyone in the West who's looking in is when
they were arrested.
They're starting to get arrested in bits and pieces. So the perception, therefore, from those that are watching the country would be, actually, when someone does this, the immediate reaction is for them to get arrested. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating to hear that this is a graduating thing.
But I think that's also strategy. And as you were saying, that the Chinese are very, very good at thinking about strategy and long-termist views. And if you go around, like the Savak did in Iran, arresting people and their families and taking babies off their mothers and all the horrible things, what you ultimately get is an uprising. Because ultimately you get to a tipping point where the people have just had enough of being oppressed. And so I think it's actually a way of kind of enforcing the censorship, but in enough of a reasonable way to keep the population pacified enough.
And we have to remember that the CCP, as is, came into being through an uprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally.
And generating that. So they've got the history of understanding how to generate that, and therefore the history of, and therefore the understanding of how to stop it from happening again.
Because I think, what, the KMT... unified China in like 1928, right? So it's not really that long ago that it became
and
a unified state.
And by unified, I think we can say the elimination of any opposing view.
level of unification.
Yes, they focused them into one place, which they've now got ambitions for, and that's Taiwan, of course.
Yeah. I want to get to that, but let's go to one of the things that's coming out in the Sajak's papers about the aspirations of the Chinese, both cyberspace, which I know is a lovely thing that you enjoy, cyberspace and military capability. Quick assessment of where China is. Is it a blue water navy yet?
Yes. They've just launched a third aircraft carrier. They have an overseas base in Africa. Therefore, they've got power projection capability. They are developing the equivalent of the Royal Navy in numbers of capital ships. They're launching on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. So the Navy is growing, their military are growing. They've been through a massive program of professionalizing and re-equipping their military. They're now sitting looking at the lessons that they can get out of the failure in Soviet-style equipment in the war with Ukraine. And I think they're going, oh, crikey, right, we need to rethink things. And that's what's slowing them down from any military action. The one thing they don't have militarily is any experience fighting.
Right.
They have not been involved operationally anywhere. So they've got lots of good kit that's in there. They've got lots of people. They will still follow the old communist types of training where it will be very scripted. And they've got no experience of military operations where it goes, from a realistic perspective, unscripted very quickly indeed. That's their Achilles heel.
Gotcha. And of course, they have the lovely model of various American aircraft carriers in the middle of the desert to familiarize
themselves. Well, and it's not just that. You know, you look at the latest Chinese aircraft, and they're direct copies of the F-35, the F-22. That's because they've got the plans. So mm-hmm. you know, they know how to, and therefore they've copied them. They know up to a point how these capabilities will work and have tried to replicate them in many cases. It'll always be flawed because you know it's never the real capability and you haven't got the training. We saw the Chinese Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army Air Force trying to get Western pilots through contract in, through a South African company to contract in to teach them how to fly from a Western perspective. They are continuously trying to improve their knowledge, their understanding and everything else. And this is a long-term program. They're mm-hmm. investing a lot of money and a lot of effort in it. And it enables the Chinese Communist Party to maintain the one thing that sets the Chinese and Chinese society apart from everyone else, I think, or most people across the world, is the level of control that they will impose. It's layered levels of control, but culturally, the Chinese people, I think, don't really care the amount of control that the government is exercising over them. But the government is exercising greater levels of control depending on what level of wealth you've got, what influence you've got, whether you're overseas, you've got access to stuff, right down to at the lowest levels, what people are doing, so they're not becoming dissenters of what's happening. And they've got mechanisms in place to be able to pull those levers. How effective they are, you'll have a more view of that than I've had. But I've talked to a few people who are professionals inside China, working in China, and when I talked to them about the levels of control and the levels of surveillance and them being tracked and all this, they said, well, I don't care. Yeah, I really just don't care. Yeah.
So, Lisa, obviously there's some taboo subjects in China and anything to do with its relationships with Taiwan and Hong Kong and not being pro-one China. What is the view of the folks that you talk to in terms of the Belt and Road initiative that China has taken in terms of external development? Do they see themselves as, a force of good?
Yeah, I think the thing you've got to remember is that because China has taken on this really steep trajectory in terms of development, I mean, it's pulled more people out of poverty, I think, since 1990. It's an unbelievable number, anyway, of people who were lifted from completely illiterate to now having a high amount of people, almost too many people going to university.
Rapidly growing middle class.
In my lifetime, which is just unbelievable. There's a lot of people who remember the situation under Mao and the sort of 1953 stuff, and how all of that has transpired. And I think the key thing that kept coming across, and it, with regards to Taiwan as well, wasn't so much that they didn't think Taiwan was part of China, and I don't necessarily think that's an appropriate debate to get into here right now, but it was more that they were concerned that a war would cripple them and put them back, mm-hmm. because actually what the Chinese people are really enjoying for the first time in a, you know, in a generation really, is they've got disposable income. They're yeah. buying Apple products, they're going to Starbucks, they're buying Teslas, which are everywhere. You know, they're enjoying all of those sorts of those things, and they don't want to let that go.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But see, I think that's why you're, from a political perspective, Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party saw a potential opportunity when Russia reinvaded Ukraine, and that potential opportunity was maybe to deal with the Taiwanese issue there and then. But as soon as the economic sanctions were put on Russia very quickly, and the Russian oligarchs and all the rest of it, you know, there are three things that drive the Chinese. Economics.
Yeah, 100%.
And therefore, very quickly, Xi Jinping will have turned around to his generals and said, you see those plans that I told you to take off and dust off and just check, put them back on the shelf.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because the timing's not right for it. it's the economic growth that is driving everything. And China has, I think, ambitions to conquer the world, not militarily, but economically.
Right.
And that's why we're seeing the influence that there is throughout. You know, it's a pervasive influence that there is throughout all the different countries at all different levels. Mm-hmm. And that's been happening, and we haven't noticed it.
Yeah, well, in places in Asia and in, the Indian subcontinent, as well as when we look at South America, all of those territories, the Chinese are not encumbered by any of sort of the Western rules that we have with regards to anti-slavery mm-hmm. or anti-money laundering. In fact, there was a big revelation of, I think it was a 1.7 billion euro Chinese money laundering operation in concert with the Italians. So
don't know why that would be
historical.
Italians don't go into money laundering or anything like
historical comfort, shall we say? Zooming in though to the issue of intellectual property, the way that America has portrayed China is they're stealing everything. Now there's some evidence to suggest that they have stolen things. But there's also a great deal of I'd say, evidence to suggest that we, as in North American corporations, gave a lot of this to the Chinese. And then we're aghast that they're capable of making, micron or the microelectronics that, you know, we had given them the capabilities to do that on our behalf. But now they're, God forbid, they're making their own thing with the stuff that we gave them. So is there a lot of confusion then about this level and state of espionage when it comes to China?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. So, as I said at the beginning, there were some definite things I went into China thinking that turned out to be wrong, and there were some things that I underestimated that turned out to be a much greater issue. I think one of the things that struck me about the Chinese that I spoke to, and I actually met a couple of people who own manufacturing plants, and they were sort of saying that, they had this attitude of, someone said, well, we make these amazing sort of 8,000 meter climbing suits, which are like a big down jacket that covers your legs and arms for climbing Everest and the big mountains of the world. And this guy was like, well, bring us one and we'll copy it. And I was sort of taken back and I was like, what? That's like throughout Chinese society.
That's business.
And to some degree, and I've given this some thought, obviously we define intellectual property theft, and there's overt sort of intellectual property theft where you've copied the brand, you've copied everything. But there's also this kind of grey area where you've taken someone's product, you've pulled it apart, which is what the Japanese did with the Mini back in the day, mm-hmm. and you've kind of re-engineered it. And what's that? Because that also sort of fits within this, and they're doing that a lot. So they're very, very good at taking copies, which I think, whilst you carry on the discussion, I'm just going to... I have two props.
Yes.
Sure. The other thing that comes in with this is, I think we've naively given things away, because the Chinese are very good. They've got a massive intelligence gathering machinery. And as you're gathering an intelligence picture, it's like collecting individual pixels off the best quality television screen that you can get. each individual pixel means nothing.
Right.
And therefore, they will have lots of people out gathering little individual pixels. They've got other people that are sitting back there going, ah, this is how these pixels go together, because they've gathered an element that allows you to do that. And they put bits of the picture together. And therefore, as they're working into our manufacturing industries in the West in different roles, you know, they will be able to show something. I remember at Defence Expo in London, having something that we manufactured when I worked for a defence manufacturing industry on our stand, and went back 2 years later to find that an exact copy of it was on the Chinese stand that made similar components. And I knew it was an exact copy because the ones that we took onto our stand, we deliberately cut flaws into it. And I went round and picked up theirs and found exactly the same flaws cut into it. That was the gun around taking photographs and remanufactured. And therefore, we let the Chinese come into our universities, into research, into everywhere else that's in there. And each little bit, in isolation, doesn't mean anything. But you put it all together, they can build the picture very, very quickly indeed. And they're working in this 25-year long-term plan, which is something that our mechanisms aren't in place to try and defend against.
It's really interesting because, you know, when you look at Japanese electronics and German electronics, you know, very high-end, very sophisticated. When you want something that's inexpensive, mass-produced at a price that you can afford, some of the Chinese electronics that are coming out in terms of surveillance technology, intercept technology, are truly phenomenal. I was just at a conference on close protection and executive protection, and one of the folks kind of said, well, here's what modern bugs look like. Absolutely blown away at the level of technology that there is now sort of common off the street. You wanted to share some props with us. Walk us through what you've discovered.
Now, the American audience might not get this, but the British audience will definitely get it. So I went into a sort of street store and found...
7-Eleven.
Like a 7-Eleven, well, yeah.
My likes.
So even at this level, China is ripping off brands, or perhaps Maltese has ripped off my likes. We haven't established that yet. Yeah. So let's just be completely fair.
It's quite Cadbury's, possibly
this is interesting because they've taken Galaxy, the chocolate bar, but they've put Dove, as in the cosmetics brand logo, on it. So that's curious. We will try these later and we'll feed back. But yeah. I think that kind of...
You can try them first.
No. I have brought you gifts. You must celebrate those gifts. I think what you're saying is quite interesting about, you know, about this and about the intellectual property side of things. And I do agree with you. But I must say, one thing that I came away from is thinking, actually, the days where we thought China makes these cheap, rubbish replicas of stuff are long gone. The quality is really, really good. And when you look at some of their brands, whether they're ripped off or not is a different question, but when you look at some of their climbing brands and their outdoor clothing brands and their electronics, really good quality stuff, really good quality cameras on their phones, really good quality, those days are long, long gone, I think, where they just made this sort of rubbish cheap stuff that came out. I mean, the cars and stuff that they're making. And I think some of the intellectual property, like my likes, obviously, they've prevented Maltesers from entering the Chinese market, right? And they've replicated Maltesers. We will feed back on later.
Is it Nestle or Cadbury that produce Maltesers?
I think it might be Nestle.
I think.
So they've relaunched this into the Chinese market, which the Chinese market is the biggest market in the world.
Right.
And this comes on to my next topic that I want to just bring into this, which is the sort of Jack Ma situation. So
yes.
Alibaba made more money just in China than Amazon made in the whole rest of the world. So that tells you how big the Chinese market is. So if you can take Maltesers and you go, okay, scrap Maltesers, we'll make my likes, push that out into the Chinese market, golden. Like, you've made loads of money. So I think a lot of the brands aren't making it outside of China. They're preventing someone coming into China, copying it, and selling it into the Chinese market. And Jack Ma has been a controversial figure, and it's really interesting talking to the younger Chinese people. They semi-idolize him, actually. And so he was the founder of Alibaba, became very, very rich, very influential, but attracted a lot of negative attention from the government because he started to become hypercritical online, saying some things that we would not expect of Chinese entrepreneurs, right? there was Western media propaganda that said he'd been put into exile, which isn't true because he comes into and out of China. He maintains a residence in China. I mean, you could argue that because he's so public, they can't do anything massively proactive.
Like
I don't know.
Anything.
When's that ever stopped them before?
Yeah.
Well, for whatever reason, they have decided to leave him be and let him go back and forth. But they have divested him of his interest in Alibaba. But he has become a sort of semi-iconic figure within the younger population, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And probably quite worrying from Xi's perspective.
Well, and this goes to a point that we made earlier about how you can be wealthy in China, but you can't be too wealthy in China.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a political reality that I think where the Communist Party, although it seems to enjoy the Western capitalism and attract Western investment in that capitalism, up to a certain level. But if it then looks like it's going to interfere with the good governance, shall we say, for the citizenry, all of a sudden there's a clampdown.
But I think there's similarities here. It's not the same, but I think there's similarities here between the way the oligarchs have influence in Russia and political influence, and the way of controlling these very, very wealthy individuals. And the way they got wealthy in the first place is they've been given a free rein and blind eyes turned by the leader, the political leadership, i.e. Vladimir Putin, allows them to get very wealthy. But there's a symbiotic relationship between all of them that as soon as they step out of that control mechanism that's in there, they are potentially a threat and they're therefore destroyed. In the same way in China, I think as people, you've got these very, very wealthy individuals, and we keep forgetting about, in the last century, the Chinese gangs that operated across the world and within Chinese communities in the United States and elsewhere, that controlled criminal enterprises that were coming in and out, and traditionally that's been there supporting Chinese leadership from the year dot. That's turned into an oligarch-type relationship that there is between Xi Jinping at the top and the senior businessmen. And if anyone steps outside the mark, like our friend from Alibaba did in his commentary against the leadership, he's very quickly pushed out into a position where his influence or his ability to influence power from a financial perspective and continuing to build his empire is restricted. And that sent us a very clear message. They're different beasts. Oligarchs in Russia are different to the similar sort of beast in China. But there are similarities in the way the relationship is from a business political perspective or a criminal political perspective.
Yeah, and I think the conviction rate for the Chinese courts is well above 95% of all cases that are brought, with usually somewhat of a harsh sentence.
Why waste resources if the person that you bring in front of you is not guilty?
Exactly. But it's interesting because some, I would say, lesser nation states in the world have either tried to embrace China, or they have garnered Chinese ill will or outrage. And we see this sort of thing with, I'm going to call it the middle powers of Canada, Australia, New Zealand. All three of those nations are sort of at fisticuff level or pushing and shoving on the global stage. The United Kingdom is kind of in a difficult spot, right? We've opened our doors to the Hong Kong immigrants coming into the United Kingdom. That's probably irritating to China somewhat because wealth is leaving Hong Kong at a fairly alarming rate. What do you think the prospects are for the relationship between the UK and China?
I think it will largely depend on what happens in the US election. I think if Trump wins, there will be a shift to the East.
Right.
Globally,
yep.
I think there will be a shift to the East. And I'm not necessarily talking China, although it is the obvious party to do trade deals and other stuff with, but Korea as well, which is on an upwards trajectory. And I think that will really put a lot of fuel behind that shift eastwards. So I think that will be the biggest drive. I actually think that my experience, that people had a very positive view of the Brits, actually, in China. It wasn't negative. They watched the king get, inaugurated or whatever you call it. And it really wasn't negative. The attitude towards the US was different.
Yeah.
not quite so positive. But I think it's interesting It's such a difficult country as well, because like Phil said, it's enormous. And it's not, there's no, and they're even aware of this, there's no Chinese person. You know, they've got Mongolians, they've got Tibetans, they've got Cantonese, Sichuanese. They speak different languages. They have different cuisines, they have different histories. It's like a unification of loads of different states almost into one country. So when you say China and Chinese people, it's like, what does that even mean? It's sort of devoid of any real substance. But we in the West and through our media, we're very reductionist in how we talk about things. So we go, Chinese people are like this and China is this. And when you go there, you're sort of like,
and
is
we
it?
Forget, you know, we forget the differences in contrast between, say, America, Texans, and Californians, and New York, and 100%.
But so we're labeling a complete people in the way that the reality is we're just labeling the government, the controlling power that's there, and the senior and the major industries, the leaders of the major industries that feed into that.
Yeah.
That's China.
Yeah.
The rest of it is, you know, all of the different ethnic and social backgrounds and everything else. And it's interesting to see the Chinese view of some of those ethnic groupings, and we see the way that the central government deals with the Uyghur people, because they see them as a potential threat that could destabilize some of the regions. So they're quite harsh in making sure that they can control that threat in a way. And again, we use that to label how they're dealing with all ethnic minorities across the place, not actually properly recognizing that the vast majority of the rest of what we call normal Chinese people are from so many different ethnic minorities, and they're just going about their daily life the way they have done for thousands of years.
I think one other thing that I just want to say that really shocked me was the attitude people had to other countries that weren't UK and the US. For example, North Korea. So this was really interesting to me, because I was under the impression very much so that China and North Korea were like best friends and getting on really well. Not the case at all.
Really?
No. And what's really interesting is the amount of absolutely hilarious propaganda that goes out about Kim Jong-un making fun of his hair, making fun of all,
really?
Like Chinese comedians making fun of him publicly within China.
Wow.
The attitude in China is actually really interesting. The Chinese people feel very, very sorry for the North Koreans. They look at that in like an empathetic way. I suspect that the situation with China and North Korea is China is trying to keep him on a short rein to avoid a war and put Americans right next to China.
Yeah.
But they probably think it would be brilliant if he stepped down and we could put someone a little bit more stable in government there.
Maybe that's his sister too, I think, because she's been involved in the North Korean. She's increasingly more present and has been at the parades.
Mm.
I want to go, as we sort of like wrap up this view, which I think has been really fascinating, I want to go to the exactly what you said, having Americans next to China, that's happening in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that a future hotspot, or do you think that's, you know, sort of tit for tat? We'll go with Phil first.
Well, I think I will just put a little bit of historic perspective and then Phil can talk about strategy. So back in the day, China created the 11-dash line, which was a line that stipulated this is basically our EEZ. We control this exclusive economic zone, ex-maritime lawyer, so this is my thing. So they created that, and then they came to an agreement with Vietnam that they can have their little bit and it will be separate. So now it exists as what we call the 9-dash line. So they've created a line, and they're claiming that part of the South China Sea belongs to China.
They're also building a few islands so that they can say, this is our sovereign territory.
Now, the thing to remember here is it is complicated. Like, there is history there that China has owned part of that. The UK has also tried to push the boundaries of how we extend our EEZ into the North Sea, which we got struck down. But I think the key thing to remember when the US starts mouthing off about this, the US never ratified UNCLOS, which is the United Nations Convention of Laws. They didn't.
They like to pull it out and say, look.
They like to pull it out. But they stand alongside, you know, states like Afghanistan, Iran, and Libya as countries that didn't ratify that convention. So whenever they start mouthing off about it, I sort of feel like you have to take that with a pinch of salt. China did ratify UNCLOS and is bound by it. So I sort of feel like that has to be a very very cautious with how you deal with that and the US view on it. The Philippines are not very happy at the moment with it. But again, I think, as Phil and I were just saying, I don't think China wants a war. And in fact, last point for me, I promise, there's a saying in China that they all live by, both in their lives but also at sort of higher levels, which is, we'll fight over the table, but we won't tip it over so we can all eat. Right?
Yeah, right.
And that is kind of, I think, absolutely the strategy with Taiwan and with the South China Sea. We'll fight over the table, but we're not going to actually do something that means that our economy is...
Or there's a plan that will unfold over the next 25 or 30 or 40 years. Yeah. Right?
I go back to what drives China. Economics, economics. The one big thing that China, even though it's such a vast country, is short of are natural resources. Hence why China is doing so much in Africa and has effectively bought Africa. Hence why China is supporting Russia covertly through the back door. It'll be buying as much natural resources as it possibly can. Hence the policy in the South and East China Seas around the Paracel and Spratly Islands. From an economic perspective, there's assessments that there are huge reserves of natural resources underneath that area of the South China Seas. So they want control over it so that they can exploit it. Yep. Hence why they're taking, you know, having ratified UNCLOS is fantastic, because, you know, they're taking sand spits, which have got no legal basis in international maritime law. They're turning them into islands, which immediately give them territorial waters around the outside and an exclusive economic zone out to 200 nautical miles around that. Again, which gives them the ability to start and exploit things. The creation of islands is not quite covered in UNCLOS in the sort of way that it's being exploited and deliberately done to try and further territorial gains. The other thing that there is through that area of the South China Seas is it's probably some of the busiest international shipping routes and shipping lanes possible, and therefore has a massive impact on international business. And for them to be able to control that is, and a lot of it's going out of China to the rest of the world or stuff coming into China, is protecting their national interests in what's going on, therefore protecting them from an economic perspective, but also enabling them to control what's going on elsewhere. And it's this little bit, it's taking little snippets of control that each one individually doesn't make a huge difference. You know, if they close the area off and force shipping to go elsewhere, it adds an extra 4 or 5 days potentially onto some of the routes, but that in itself isn't going to cause a conflict. But you start to do that with everything that they've got across the place, and their ownership of other natural resources, and in particular rare earth metals is somewhere that I look at. They own 90% of the global supply of rare earth metals from economically viable mines, and they're needed for every bit of electronics that are coming out, and we're becoming a more electronically enabled world. And they own it in Australia, and they own it, a lot of the mines in Australia, they're physically owned by Chinese companies. That's why we're getting the Australasian countries going, oh, we're worried about this, because they've let it happen. Under political oversight, they haven't realised what it is it's doing. And that's why China's slowly but surely getting that economic influence, putting its tendrils out across the globe. It's almost like the mycelium of a fungi in a forest as it's working its way through. And then every now and again, you get the mushrooms that pop up.
Amazing. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for your analysis on China and all things Chinese. This comes... we'll be releasing the report from Sajax on China, and your feedback has been absolutely tremendous. Thank you to our sponsor, Sajax, and Security Magazine for hosting it.
Yay!
Even open my likes. Okay, so this is Ian, Phil, and I sampling the
My Likes
glorious product that is My Likes, which may or may not be a ripoff of Maltesers.
So I'll be drinking it from the official cup.
I'll put my official tester's official badge on. Yeah. Right.
So here we go. Okay. My Likes.
Three,
my
like. Two, one.
It's close. I would say it's close to Maltesers, but it's chocolate's not quite there.
The chocolate's not there, and the inside's a bit chewier, and not it's not as light.
Yeah.
Okay, we have one more treat to try.
And it's very sweet. There's a lot of sugar in it.
Yeah.
Well, we think it's sugar.
Yeah.
So this is Dove, which is Galaxy branded with a moisturizer brand.
Right, yeah.
Oh, so, those are disgusting, actually.
They got a bit of a kick, haven't they, at the end?
Yeah. Wow. So,
yeah. It's,
oh my goodness.
It's not really a color found in nature.
Well, it's bright green. All right. It smells a bit like green tea.
It does a bit, yeah.
Oh, hang on, that could be. Hey, man.
That's better. That's better than my lights. Mm. No, it is.
I don't know, it's not really...
It's the Chinese equivalent of white chocolate with something herbal in it.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Hey.
No.
You would prefer my likes? Okay, can we get some votes for my likes?
Okay, I would do my likes over the pretend Dove Galaxy.
I'm going Dove. What
really?
Are you going
I'm
for?
I'm going neither.
You they're have both, to pick one.
They're both disgusting. I could probably eat the Dove. I couldn't eat a packet of those.
My likes.
Yeah.
There you go. So
I need a beer to wash that
up. We're going
to
get a beer.